We're here. Reach out with Ray and Steve. And Ray, welcome another edition of our show here.
Number one, do you have a hairbrush?
I don't have a hairbrush.
Your hair's sticking up like Don King to the left, but like Lou Costello to the right.
We'll fix it after the show.
You're paying a makeup girl about $15,000 a month, and you can't even get her to brush your hair.
I know. I ran right from Queens and right here, massive traffic. But you know what?
You always got to you always got an excuse.
Dude. I always got an excuse.
Okay, because here's my problem.
What's your problem?
We got like three very terrific.
Yes, we
guests,
do. Yes,
and they
we
got
do.
Here before you.
I know.
I don't get it.
I can't figure that
Dude,
one out.
We're getting paid mega dollars to be doing this show, and you can't show up on time.
Well, you know.
I know that you're a big celebrity now on the play.
Now we're going to talk about Bat Boy. But before we get into all that, the Red Sox took the World Series.
No, before we get into all of that, I'm angry.
Okay.
What's happened in Pittsburgh is a disgrace to humanity, to life. And, when are we going to get it? When are we going to get it? You know, this is the one time I'm very serious about that. I just don't. It starts when they're children.
Right.
Okay. And, you know, we can blame everybody and anybody, but, you know, it's just a disgrace of what's happened to our country and where we're going. And how are we going to leave this country when we leave here as far as our kids and our grandkids, etc.? I mean, it's like they're being born into a situation where they think this is the way it's supposed to be. Where they think this is the way it's always been.
Well,
and it wasn't always like this.
Right.
And, you know, something I'm going to touch base a little bit with our guests, because we've got a couple of different generations. You know, number one, I'm excited about the fact that we got the Disco Man, Disco Dom Scala.
Yes, we
the
do.
The first bullpen catcher in the history of baseball, the first official bullpen catcher in the history of the game. So we're going to talk about that.
Yes.
And then we're going to talk with another great guest and a guy who did it in the major leagues for a long time. And what a career, because he was a guy that, in essence, the game almost tried not to have him go in, you know, and yet he proved to the world that he was one of the best hitters in baseball.
Yes.
And I can say that because I got a beautiful text. I'm going to show it to you. You didn't see it yet because you were late. From Roberto Alomar, the greatest second baseman of all time, who says he's got incredible respect for this man. We're going to talk to him about that and what's he think about that. Because Robbie, you never give compliments to anybody. And you know it. I know you're watching the show, and you never give compliments to anybody. And I'm pissed off because you give one to Frank Catalanato. I'm supposed to be like your big brother, and Frank Catalanato. He's the greatest. I respect him. He's like, I read his book. You didn't even read my book, but you read his book. We'll discuss that later, Rob.
Yeah, okay. Well, two great guests. And another third guest, Joe McDonald, you know.
Terrific Joe McDonald gave me my first opportunity to write on a regular basis for New York Sports Day. And I'm grateful to him for that. He's cheap as hell. He don't pay. But he's very good publisher. Right. And I'm very happy to be with him.
Well, it goes that this TV gig doesn't pay either, so, you know.
Steve, so you don't have to tell anybody.
You mean we're not getting paid?
No. What did Ray tell you?
Nice, Steve.
But to get back to the whole Pittsburgh thing.
He told me go to Steve for the check.
Oh, yes. That's already okay.
My social security number is.
give it up. I want you to give it up.
But the whole Pittsburgh thing, it's happening more frequently. It's happening in schools and malls and churches and synagogues, and it's out of control. So gun control laws have to be passed. And then also, you know, mental health looks to that to be looked at more carefully as well. So it's happening way too frequently. And the kids I teach in the schools, you have to reteach them about 9/11 because we're far removed from it now too. So a lot of things have changed since 9/11. But you're absolutely right to start the show off that way. So
for the people out there that don't know, Steve is also a psychologist in the school systems here in Long Island, and I kid around with him a lot and I slap him around a little bit. But he is actually very good at what he does as far as the children, and this is why we partnered up, because of your work with children, and something that's extremely important to me.
And it's funny because the kids that we first met with, I brought to your attention when you were doing a book presentation at Suffolk Community College, came from Smithtown, and Frank comes from Smithtown too, so we'll talk more about that.
Which just shows you that now, Frank may be like a little bit of a bully and stuff.
I don't know, but there's a difference between Smithtown East and Smithtown West. Maybe Frank will allude to that in a little while.
Well, I want
to
understand what that's all about. So.
But the Red Sox took the World Series. What are your thoughts about that?
I'm disappointed because I wanted 7 games. Every year I root for 7 games, and it disappoints me because I used to watch with my dad, who I lost a couple of years ago, and that was our thing, was to watch a 7-game World Series and be excited about it. And now I feel like, what am I going to watch tonight, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, hey, the best team won as far as I'm concerned.
Well, they certainly turned their legacy around. They hadn't won a World Series in almost 100 years. Now they've won 4 in the past 15 years or so. Joe, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, if you're looking at the Red Sox, they actually play the game correctly. If you look at the way their offense is built, instead of a whole bunch of boppers like Rays Yankees, you know, and you shut them down, they don't hit home runs, they don't score, you have a bunch of guys in the lineup who just fit into the lineup and move things along. They have J.D. Martinez with the home runs, okay? But Mookie Betts looks like the best player in baseball.
Right.
He was one of the he's the toughest out. They're all tough outs, you know, and if you get them out and there's runners on base, they're doing something productive with those outs. So they'll hit to the right side, you know, they're hit to the right side with a runner on second to move them over to third.
Right.
You don't see that anymore in baseball because everyone's analytics, everyone's home runs, everyone's like, you know, if I hear the term launch angle anymore, I'll be like, you know, I'm going to scream. So, you know, it was a breath of fresh air, and it was a very easy team to root for. I think the most impressive thing was after game 2, Mookie Betts went out, bought food, went to a homeless shelter, and fed the homeless. No media there. Someone happened to put it on social media. That's how everyone found out. Didn't want publicity, just fed the homeless after winning game 2.
Wow.
That's a beautiful day. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful day. Mm-hmm. Disco Dom, tell us a little bit about your feelings about the World Series.
Well, you know, the thing that I liked about Boston from August, and I told my guys, you know, I always make references, you know, to my college players about the pros because that's what I know. And I said, look, I said, if you want to win, watch teams like the Boston Red Sox who are selfless. You know, people, you know, guys that they pull for each other. You know, watch them in the dugout. Look at what happened with Benintendi. Benintendi didn't play, and I believe the first game in Los Angeles. He doesn't put his head down. He stays there, and he waits for his opportunity to come off the bench that game or play the next 2 games as he did. So I thought that the Boston Red Sox, and I told my guys that they'll win in 5. That's no lie. You can ask some of my guys. I said, they'll win in 5. Mm-hmm. I said, that team was destined from August, I thought, when I first really watched them, to win the World Series, because a lot of things went their way, and they made a lot of things go their way, the way they played. They swing at the first pitch, they're aggressive, on the bases, and their pitchers are aggressive. And another, one more thing, I disagreed, I thought that their bullpen was pretty good. Hey, how can you go wrong? Every guy's throwing 95 to 98 to 100. Kelly, you know, a lot of guys, 97, 98, that's Barnes. They're pretty good. They were pretty good.
Well, next time I go to Vegas, I'm taking you with me because you're picking them out like that.
That's the first time, by the way, that's the first time in 20 years I'm a donator to anything. I just donate to anything, any type of raffle or anything. I'm a donator.
So, Frank, tell us a little bit about your thoughts of the World Series and how it went along.
Well, you know, watching the Red Sox, it was impressive for me because they play the game the right way. And I can appreciate that even more so now being a college coach because I'm trying to change the culture and make my team a team that plays hard every single play, every single game, every single play, runs balls out hard. And when young kids, college kids, are watching teams that jog to first base and don't play the game hard, it's tough for them to listen to me when they're watching major leaguers do it that way. So when you watch the Red Sox, the way they play the game, the at-bats that they have, the quality at-bats, it's impressive. They don't, you know, you watch some teams, they go up there and you can tell everyone's trying to hit a home run. These guys from 1 to 9, they have quality at-bats. They make the pitcher work, get deep into pitch counts, and it was impressive for me, and like everyone's been saying, the best team in baseball did win the World Series.
Now, I've been watching Dom with Adelphi University for I don't know how many years now.
This is my 16th.
16 years.
Wow.
And I know his style per se. What's going to be your style now starting over at New York Tech?
Well, I'm trying to figure it out. You know, I've never coached at the college level. And, you know, I don't know. People ask me, are you going to play small ball? Are you going to rely on the home run? I can tell you I'm not going to rely on the home run. But I'm going to ask my players to show up every single day and give 100%. Run balls out. And like I've told them already, if you don't run a ball out, you're out of the game. I'm taking you out. And I've had some good managers in the major leagues that did that. If you didn't run a ball out, if you didn't hustle, you were taken out of the game. And I think if I can create this culture and make sure that my team is playing hard at all times, when we go in to play other teams, they're going to know, oh, shoot, they're coming in. You can't take a play off because they're going to be running hard if it's a ground ball to the second baseman, the shortstop. And so I'm going to expect my team to play hard all the time. But as far as, you know, how I'm going to manage, I think I've got to kind of get into some games first and figure out. I definitely feel like I will be the type of guy that's going to put on some bunts and hit and runs, but I'm looking forward to kind of finding my style.
I know that Dom was influenced greatly by Billy Martin.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that. You know, Frank, when I first came from the major leagues to college, I brought the Yankee traditional baseball mm-hmm. to Adelphi, and unfortunately, I took over a team that was 6-36.
Or fortunately.
Yeah. Or fortunately, mm-hmm. I took a team over 6-36, so they needed a total makeover. So what I did is I tried to instill discipline, you know, like you're trying to mm-hmm. do: run balls out, run balls hard. Hey, listen, I say to them, what do? You run once every 20 minutes, right? You can't run hard once every 20 minutes in an at bat. Come on, pop up. You can't run it out. You know what I'm saying? So that is something that I tried to do. I used the Yankee way, even with their haircuts. And I told them they had to look good. They had to look neat. When we first went on road trips, we went to Florida, they wore suits. I've cut that down a little bit now. But back then, I made them wear suits on the plane because that's what we did as a Yankee and that's what we did as major leaguers. So that's what I tried to do. I tried to instill the pro mentality, yet you have to conform with the college game. So you got to do a little bit of both.
So, that's Frank, great. Let me ask you. You played for probably 7 different major league managers throughout the years.
That sounds about right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, the Tigers, the Rangers, Blue Jays, Rangers, Brewers, and Mets. Yeah.
Which was the guy that most influenced you as a manager?
Larry Parrish.
Okay.
So I had Larry. You remember Larry?
Sure.
I mean, I had Larry in the minor leagues. He was the roving hitting instructor, and then he became the manager in, I believe it was 1999. So I spent a lot of time with him, and I credit him with getting me to the major leagues because he took me under his wing, and he taught me not only he totally changed my swing around and taught me not only the mechanics of baseball, but also the mental part of the game and the mental part of hitting. And that helped me so much. You have to try to get that mental edge and you know, have a game plan going up there. And that's something that I'm looking forward to teaching, helping these college kids with, is going up there with a plan, with a purpose, and not just going up and just, seeing the ball and hitting the ball. But before you do that, having a plan, knowing what that pitcher is trying to do to get you out, and what you may want to, you know, look for in certain situations. I think that's something that helped me stay in the league for as long as I did. And if I can help them with the mental part of the game, I think that'll give them a little bit of an edge.
Now, Dom, you were a ninth round draft pick, if I remember correctly. Okay,
yeah, seventh, really.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. Seventh. Well, who's counting?
Yeah,
okay, I got you. Now, Frank, what
who
round?
Asked
did,
me?
What round did you go?
Tenth round.
Okay. Now, here's the scenario. 1978. He was like on the bubble, and mm-hmm. then he got released.
Right.
Okay. You were on the bubble at one time, I remember.
But somebody decided that, hey, you know what? I got to stick with this kid a little longer. I mean, what is that fine line? I mean, because that's what you have to do as a coach in college. You know that more than anybody, yeah. Dom. You know?
Yeah, you get kids from all over the place that are all league guys and all city guys, and mm-hmm. now all of a sudden they're sitting on the bench mm-hmm. for most of the year, so it's tough. But our job is to develop them as best we can. And what I've seen through the years is that don't give up on them the first year, because right. they could get bigger and stronger and faster the second year and the third Boom. Year and the fourth year. Right. And you never know when somebody's going to come off the bench and help you out, and then you never take them out.
See, this is the beauty of having the two of you here. This is why I wanted you guys here so bad, and I didn't want one without the other, mm-hmm. because of where your careers went. Mm-hmm. Because someone stuck with Frank, and what a fabulous career you had. Thank you know what I'm saying?
Thank you. I was very lucky, very, very fortunate that that they did stick with me. And again, I'll go back to Larry Parrish. He told me a story that it was early in my minor league career that at the end of spring training, they brought all the brass to a meeting, and they were going through names, and my name came up, and they said, the coordinator, minor league coordinator, said, let's release him, let's get rid of him. And no one in the room other than Larry Parrish stood up and said, no way, this kid, he wants to work, he's out there early, I can help him. And they said, no, he's gone. You know, he hasn't done anything, he's gone. And I was told by other guys that were in that meeting that Larry Parrish was adamant about, this one's on me. If he doesn't work out, you guys can blame me. And sure enough, they let me stick around, and Larry came up to me later that day or maybe the next day and said, Frank, I want you early for early batting practice. And I was there. And then for the rest of the time together, I was there early and late after the games, after the whole day of spring training. I was there. And like I said, he took me under his wing, and just with his tutelage, I was able to get better. Again, not only the mental part, not only the physical part, but the mental part. And sometimes you need to have a guy in your corner like that.
Mm-hmm. Because, you need the Godfather.
No doubt.
Yeah, you need the Godfather.
Because, you know, yeah. I could have been gone like that. And had I been released, chances are I never would have played again or never would have got to the major leagues. But I needed somebody in my corner. And luckily it was Larry. And, you know, I was able to get to the major leagues.
Ray had the Pope.
Yes, he did.
He had the Pope.
Yes, he
no,
did.
But the beauty of this is, I remember when you got to the Yankees in 78 and curious and scared. I think that's fair to say.
Well, yeah, I don't know if I was scared. I was in awe.
Yeah.
I think I was in awe. I mean, I put the pinstripes on.
Right.
Well, world champions.
I was number 51, and in those days,
that was now a big number.
51 is a real number now.
Yeah. Right. You know? The lowest number that they have to give out now.
Yeah. Yeah.
But my number was like, you know, right. Give him 51. That's Goose like was 54. Yeah. He was the highest right. at the time.
Yeah.
And I remember going out on the field, and you know, it was a nice night and everything, and they sent me to the bullpen because I had a warm up, Dick Tidrow. Uh-huh. They said if he can handle Dick Tidrow, sure. he can handle anybody. And, you know, because Dick Tidrow used to have that nasty sinker, you know what I mean, that he used to throw. Mm. And he did hurt my hand a lot, but I caught it. You know?
I got to tell you something about that. Before they hired Dom, okay, before they hired him, they asked me, you want to give it a shot?
Really?
I went to the bullpen. Dirt was throwing, Dick Tidrow.
Yeah.
He threw this he threw this slider that went over here and went down and hit me in the ankle, and then he was laughing as I was going, I call you.
Really?
You know, he would laugh, and I left up, what do you call it, and that never went back. Never went back, and next thing you know, about 2 days later, the legend of Disco Dom started.
And I'll tell you what, it was the best time of my life. I mean, how lucky. I mean, you talk about, like I said before, I never won anything in my life, really. Like, I'm always donating to any cause, you know what I mean? Like any raffle or something like that. And my first year with the Yankees in the big leagues, I get a ring, you know? And you talk Amazing. About a guy like Don Mattingly, who has never gotten a ring,
right.
who, you know, a great ball player, one of the greatest of all time, Yankees. And, you know, he would love to have a ring, you know. So I was so fortunate and so blessed, you know, to be part of that whole situation and the guys and everything like that, you know.
Now, Frank, I got a text from the greatest second baseman of all time, the great Roberto Alomar, who I love Robbie like a little brother. I used to babysit him when his dad played second base for the Yankees. Yes, Robbie. And and so, and I said, I know that he's watching right now, because he said, well, it's going to be watching only because the terrific, wonderful Frank Catalanato is on the show today. And this was the text that I'm going to read it, okay, just to teach you a lesson, Robbie. Say hi to Frank. He can hit. Great person, smart, and plays the game hard day in, day out. My respect to him. Now, this is where I'm mad at you, Robbie. And he has an awesome book. I mean, he took the time to read your book. I've done five books. He's never, I even have children's books, 10 pages, and you never even read that. You know, you read Frank's book. I mean, it was a great book. Everybody out there, go to the internet and buy Frank's book. But Frank, what do you say about that?
Well, you say Robbie's the greatest second baseman of all time, which is true, but he's probably one of the greatest people of all time. Just what a great, what a big heart he has,
right.
Always doing things for other people.
Yes.
You know, I get to do a bunch of things with him in Toronto. Golf outings, charity softball games, youth camps and clinics,
right.
And he's always donating his time and
right.
doing all these things. You know, you would think he would sit back and just enjoy life. He's out. That's how he enjoys life, by helping other people.
Right.
So thank you, Robbie, for the message, and I'm sure I'll see you soon. But again, a great guy.
Yes,
isn't it great, the people that you meet in the game? And I also tell my college kids that. I said, you're never going to forget all of your friends here because you're doing and you're experiencing winning and doing different things with each other on and off the field, that you're going to have memories forever.
Right.
It's true.
Because, I mean, think about all the people who we've been with in baseball, from college to pro. Think about, like you just said, a lot of great people that do great things, and, you know, you're happy to be with them and to know them.
Yep. Well, I mean, you've had, again, Willie Randolph always says to me, Ray, how do you remember all the things? Because all of my writings and stuff like that,
I say the same thing to him all the time.
And he says, how do you remember all that? And I say the same thing to Willie all the time. Willie, do you forget that I wasn't a player? So I used to go into that clubhouse every day. I couldn't wait to get into the clubhouse and strap in, because I was watching the greatest show on earth.
Right. Yeah.
And I used to watch this guy do this. I used to watch Disco Dom do that. I used to watch Catfish do that. I mean, come on, the greatest. And it was fun. I used to watch the fights. When the fights broke out, I would be right there. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, hit him. You know what I'm saying? I wasn't rooting for anybody. I just wanted the fight to keep on going because it was fun. You know what I'm saying?
The bus rides, the plane trips. You know what I mean? There's always something great going on.
How about when Mickey Rivers beat up our traveling secretary that time? Mickey, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
So, I mean, and then when this man, when the whole Saturday Night Fever craze hit, and everybody realized that Dom Scala was the best dancer on the team. So who, Paul Blair give you that name,
yes,
Disco
he did.
Dom?
Yes, he did.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, Paul Blair, we used to go out with a lot of the guys back in the day.
One of the greatest defensive center fielders of all time.
And a great guy.
And
another
great
guy.
Yeah.
You talk about a great guy.
Yes.
Yeah. And he left us too soon. At a club one night, you know, a bunch of the guys, you know. In those days, everybody was, you know, together. You know what I mean? That's how we bonded, you know?
Right.
And he saw me on a dance floor and this, that, and the other. Comes in the clubhouse the next day. He goes, you know how he used to go, Disco Dom. He goes, Disco Dom, you can dance, man. And you're not black, he used to say. You're a white guy.
Oh, God. And the steps that he had. And he used to wear the fancy shoes and the steps that he, oh, my God.
Really? Maybe we can get a little up.
I would love it.
Didn't George come to
We're at a discotheque in Detroit. Okay, I think it was Detroit.
And so Steinbrenner, he was hearing whims of all these different things were going out, this and that, blah, blah, blah. He shows up at a discotheque. And so he goes over to me. He says, Ray, when is this discotheque guy going to start his act?
Disco down.
I ran out.
Well, this is Reach Out with Ray and Steve. If you want to call in, please do it. 631-415-1365.
Don't call in.
631-415-1365. Now, Frank, you on May 1st in 2004, talk about that day. You had 6 hits that day. Talk about that.
That was a good one. That the ball looked like a beach ball coming in. You know, anyone that's played the game knows that there are some days that the game just slows down. And this particular day, I was seeing the ball like it was, like I said, like a beach ball. And, you know, after I got my first hit, I knew I was feeling good. And then, you know, the next hit came, and I think it was the 4th inning, and I already had 3 at-bats and 3 hits. And someone came up to me, I think it was Vernon Wells at the time. He goes, man, you might get 4 or 5 hits today. I go, I don't know how many hits I'm going to get today, but however many at-bats I get, that's how many hits. Because right now I just feel like I'm in the zone. Like I'm going to hit everything hard.
Well, we're going to show our viewers some of this. So I'm going to play it now as you're talking about it, because 6 hits in one game, any level, is incredible.
Yeah.
Major league level.
It was pretty early in the season. I think, like you said, it was May, right?
Right, May 1st.
So my batting average probably went from, I remember it was like, went from like 250 to like 360 or something.
You were the player of the week that week.
Yeah. So, as a player, you wish you can bottle those moments up, and you know they only come around once in a blue moon. But I'll remember that. I remember that day vividly.
Hey Frank, player of the week. He gets a watch, right?
Yep.
Now what you do with the watch?
I gave it to my dad.
Oh, yep. That's cool. Yep. That's cool. You know, I used to like, you know, whenever a guy got player of the week, or every once in a while they would
hang out
the watch. How many watches did you get from Player of the Week? So you got a couple.
I got a Yankee logo. That's what I got.
So I got a question. I got a question for all 3 of you guys. Because what's the difference between the college level game and the major league game? Because now the shift's going on. You don't see bunting as much. Are you going to teach bunting, or have you been? What's your philosophy with that?
Oh, my guys bunt every day. You know, it's part of the game. I try to get guys, you know, to look around. Like Frank said about, you know, the mental part of the game. You know, you're a leadoff hitter, or maybe it's one out, and you know you're a fast guy. Hey, why not try to lay one down, get on base, keep the merry-go-round going? You know what I mean? I'm always stressing bunting. Sometimes I have to lay off of it because I don't want them to think that I'm a bunting guy, because I was a hitter. When I played in the minor leagues and in college, I was a hitter, and I know the importance of hitting it. But I also know the importance of moving guys and keeping it going.
Right.
And in college, a lot of people use the bunt.
Right.
A lot of people use the bunt.
Right. So, Joe, what do you think on the major league level?
I think the major difference that you're seeing, at least today, is that the major league level, most of these teams have analytics people, and analytics is taking over the game. On a college level, most college programs don't have, and because of the fluidity of the type of players, because you have different players changing every single year. So every 4 years, you're basically overturning the league. You're not going to have that. You're not going to be able to have that type of snapshot of stats and everything else. So I don't think so. They're going to have to be a little bit more traditional back into how the way they play the game. They got to move runners along. They got to manufacture runs. They're not going to rely on the home run. The pitchers aren't going to be as developed in terms of the types of pitches they throw. Right. A lot of them throw just, you know, maybe like, because they can get away with a guy with a 98-mile-an-hour fastball, get away with a fastball and possibly a curveball.
Right.
Whereas in the majors, he's going to need 3 or 4 pitchers, even if he has a 98-mile-an-hour fastball. They also can get away with mistakes because, you know, they could throw a ball down the middle and strike a guy out. A major league hitter is going to catch up to that fastball.
Right.
Now, let me ask you, you were covering the Mets today as far as the new general manager situation.
Correct.
I mean, where do we go with that?
Well, they have a new general manager, Brody Van Wagner. He was the super agent at CAA, you know, probably after Scott Boras, maybe up there as one of the most powerful agents in the game, and he decided to give it all up to run the Mets. To me, it's a lot of people are killing the idea because, oh, he's never worked in a front office before and everything. I don't think it's that bad of a move in terms of you're going to have a certain type of skill sets. Okay, you're going to have to speak to people. You're going to have to schmooze with people. You're going to have to talk with other GMs around the league. The agents, as we were talking before the show, they have their own analytics department. They have their own scouts. They go out and scout players before the majors do, because they're signing players. When it comes to the free agents, you know, of high-end free agents, they'll send out a book this thick, I guess you can say it there, this thick to, like, all the teams with stats upon stats of why this is the greatest player of all time, and you need to give him the most money of all time. Now he's doing it on the other end. So I don't think it's totally outside of the box. We've seen agents before, mainly in the NBA, with both the Lakers and the Warriors coming in and actually having agents run the team. And they currently do. And the one who ran the Lakers just signed LeBron, so, you know, how bad could that be?
Right.
But, you know, you've seen it in baseball before with Joe Garagiola Jr., right. Dave Stewart, Jeff Morad actually owned. Left and became actually an owner.
Right. Right.
You know, as well. So it's not like it's not unheard of before. And the bottom line is no one's going to be talking about this in 2 years if the Mets win.
Now, is this an ego thing for this Van, what's his name, Van Buren?
Van Wagner.
Oh, you'll get scolded for that.
I just saw the guy today, you know. I mean, it is. Serious question. As an agent, I mean, you guys I've been listening to some of you guys up in the press box and stuff like that. My question to you is about how much was he making as an agent?
Well, I didn't get a copy of his tax return.
No, serious. I mean,
seriously. They get what, 10-15%?
You get 5%.
Say 5%, okay? So let's just say the total commute, you know, he probably gets between 40-50% of that, and the rest of it goes to CAA.
Okay.
So, you know, he may have taken a pay cut. He says, what I made is not as much as what you guys think, which is probably true in the case. You know, we probably think he makes a lot more than he probably did. He had to do a lot of payouts and everything else, the staff and everything. So, you know, I don't think he's got, I think he's making a, you know, he made decent money, but, you know, agents make, you know, general managers make $1.5 million a year anyway. So, you know, on the low end, you know, a guy like Brian Cashman, how much
is he? Yeah, but he's been there 20 some odd years.
I understand that, but still an average GM is making seven figures. So.
You know, my take on it is that, like anybody else, sometimes you get burnt out in a job,
right.
You know, and you want to try something different. And I'm sure that he's very comfortable, this guy, as far as what he's made with his company. And I think he just wanted something a little different. Now, let me just say this, look at it this way. He now knows both. He's going to start knowing both sides. In other words, he was on this side talking,
right.
You know, as an agent. Now he's going to be on the opposite side, and he's going to know some of the answers that he used to ask.
Right.
So I think it's a partly an ego thing maybe for him. Maybe mm-hmm. he felt that he can really do a good job. Okay, and the other part is, maybe he got a little bit burnt out and tired of the job that he had, because it's not an easy job. I know an agent very well. Okay. And, you know, a lot of traveling, a lot of babysitting, a lot of things go on behind the scenes. It's not just the money you make.
Now, Frank, you've had a couple agents in your career. Now, if your agent was Van Wagner. And he became, all of a sudden, he became the general manager of the Detroit Tigers. Would you expect for him to be more fairer, if that's the right word, to you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
He would definitely favor me. You know, you show favoritism.
You would expect that.
I would expect that.
Now,
yeah.
All of a sudden, I'm the agent. Look, Frank, I love you. You know, I'm your kid's godfather and all that, but I this is all I got.
Right.
That's all I can give you, buddy.
And now you got to think about it this way. How many millions of dollars that the guys, I think you guys told me Syndergaard and whatever, have paid right. this guy.
Well, that's right? That, well, they right. paid CAA.
Not him. But him, CAA, him.
But he's still yeah. represented by, they're still represented by CAA.
Right.
I understand right. that, but he was the head guy.
He was their agent.
He was the head guy.
He was their guy.
And how many guys did he represent on the Mets?
Nine.
Well,
nine.
Yeah, it was like, it's Syndergaard, DeGrom, Frazier.
Nine.
Seems like a conflict. Okay.
Nine, all right, Mr. James.
Ray says right. nine. All I'm saying,
but sounds like but a if guys are making that. $15, $20 million and he's getting a percentage over the course of the last however many years,
yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Now you saw Robbie Alomar, one of the class, says Frank Catalano, one of the class people in all of baseball, and you saw. I mean, it was like he's expecting that. Hey, you got to take care of me really, now.
But think
you
about this.
That's how Syndergaard and all these other guys are going to be.
There's only going to be really three guys on the Mets who really care because a lot of them are going to be gone anyway. Cespedes not getting another contract. Frazier's gone after next year. Vargas is gone after next year. Syndergaard, DeGrom, and possibly Nimmo. Those are the only ones that would really affect. And Nimmo is a young guy anyway, so it's not like he's even made his money.
Well, you know, but now you got Cespedes who's going to say, Van Cortlandt, I'm going to play golf. You okay with me doing that?
Right.
Okay? You know what I'm saying? And what's he going to say to him?
Or he could be like...
Well,
like,
he says if you can walk, yes, you can. And that's what he probably will say to him right now.
Or he could be like your father. Like if your father was coaching you in a game, he's a little harder on you than the other guys. So maybe he's
now
gonna
he's
be
gonna
hard.
Really now Cespedes is really gonna be mad.
But
also
you.
Dom, you said when you took over at Delphi, they yeah. had a losing record. So that to you sounded like a motivation or incentive to turn things around. Maybe he sees it the same way as well.
Yeah, and that is true.
But he made them seem like they were the greatest team since the 1927 Yankees today.
Yeah, that's what I heard. I heard he made like
but there's still work to be done. But the fact of the matter is, there was a challenge for you when you took over at Delphi. So was that a motivating factor to take that gig?
Oh yeah. I wanted to be a college coach. That was my next step.
Right.
And even though it was a 6-36 team, I said to myself, "How do I get to turn this around?" And the first thing I said was, "I got to instill the Yankee way
right.
into them." The way George Steinbrenner and Billy Martins and the Bob Lemons and the Gene Michaels.
I think Dom is trying to get back to the Yankees. Okay?
Love to.
Uh-huh. But Frank, now you're taking over a program that's had some issues the last couple of years.
Yep.
What's your take on that? How are you going to turn that program around?
Well, it's one of the reasons why I wanted to take the job because I viewed it as a challenge. And... you know, I'm a very competitive person, and I want to see what my influence and my staff's influence can be on this.
You got a hell of a coaching staff,
great
too,
coaching
by the
staff.
Way.
Jimmy,
jeez,
you know that we've got
major
a
major league coaching
a
staff,
a lot of professional experience mm-hmm. there.
Why don't you name some of them? So
yeah, so Jimmy Gels, he played 10 years in the minor leagues. Chris Rojas is my pitching coach. He played 10 years in the minor leagues. Ray Gianelli played like 10 years in the minor leagues and a little bit in the major leagues as well. Frank Battaglia, he coached Queens College for almost 10 years, I believe. So we've got a really good, knowledgeable staff. And like I said, I'm looking forward to the challenge of making this team better. Now, the guys that I've got now are not my recruits, right? But I still feel like over the course of the last 6 weeks, these players have gotten better. And, you know, we're you know, teaching all aspects of the game and we expect them to every single day, whether it's a practice or a game, to be focused, to bring, you know, to work 100%, to work hard. And that's what they've done. The whole fall, they've been engaged. They want to learn, and like I said, they've been getting better. So it's been fun for me. And I think if we just stay at it, and you know, this whole winter, if we continue to work on the swing and the mental part of the game, the approach at the plate, we'll be fine come springtime.
I mean, unbelievable. With my 1 year in the minor leagues, I could be his ball boy. Unbelievable.
So why is it difficult for Long Islanders? You came from Smithtown East to make it to the major level or major league level, or why is it difficult for that?
Well, I guess you got to look at the fact that we don't play year round, right? In Florida, California, Texas, you know, they're playing year round. Right. You know, you don't get as much exposure up here as they do in the warmer climates. I took it as a positive. I felt like getting some months off where I could rest my body and work on, agility and weightlifting and stuff like that. I felt like that was good for me. But, for most people, they've got to be playing in games all the time to get better. And I think that's the reason why we don't see as many guys from the Northeast in the Major
League. Funny thing is that what Frank's saying is correct. However, in the Northeast, the scouts and the major league teams take more pitching than infielders and outfielders. And the reason why is that they don't throw as much because they do get a little bit more time off.
Right.
That's something that was explained to me a little while ago.
Right.
And it's funny because I've had 7 pitchers drafted and 3 position plays in the last 15 years. So in other words, you got 7 pitchers and 3 position. And I tell people it's very hard for position players to get drafted from the Northeast.
Right.
But now, pitching is a little different.
Right.
Now, Dom, I mean, your people are flooding our phones over here.
They better.
You have a Sal Amato.
Oh, Sal Amato.
A classmate at St. Francis Prep.
Oh, oh.
And then you got a guy named Gil. He says, I'm still looking for my money.
Well, he's not getting it.
You know?
Don't tell him the address here, by the way.
And then somebody,
he'll be out in the parking lot.
Then somebody talking about the Giglio Festival.
The Giglio. A Lady of Mount Carmel feast. What? Where they lift the Giglio. You ever hear about when they lift the saint?
Uh-huh.
I used to do that back in the day. You ever hear of that?
Yeah, I've heard of it.
You've heard of it, right? In Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
In Williamsburg, Brooklyn. They do them all over. The Bronx, they do it.
He's the one non-Italian guy here.
Listen, for your information, see, I want you to get his ass out of here.
Well.
For your information, I lived in Williamsburg for 10 years. And I'm very proud of my Williamsburg heritage.
And you never went to the feast?
You know what? I didn't. I was there, as my friend Gil knows.
Wasn't there that day.
My friend Gil knows. I was very careful of my good friends, the Italianos.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I was very, very careful.
Do you know?
I love the Italianos. Remember, my children are half Italian.
I know. Do you know? I used to fight against Julio Cruz. Remember Julio Cruz?
Oh, my goodness.
From Seattle?
Yes.
He's from the south side.
Uh-huh.
I'm from the north side.
Okay.
So when we met in like 78 or 79, we took a picture together. I said, I'm going to save it as pictures. We would never be together taking a picture back in
not
the old
10
days.
Years before.
Not in the old days.
Uh-uh. Really? No, sir. And then you
south
had the Hasidic side. The Hasidic Hebrews.
Yes.
They were a very nice gentleman, too.
Yes.
Okay, they used to chase me home every day, and they used to go, Gaia Hein means go home. And I would be like, please,
oh, you would have got you would have got it through smoke bombs in the chicken coops. I remember
that's why I had to run fast.
That's right.
Okay. Right.
Those
were some very tough dudes. The Hasidics were very tough hombres.
Yeah, they had the hatchet in their hand.
But yes.
Because they had to cut the chickens' heads off.
But you did not mess around. Us and the brothers did not mess around with the Italianos. No, sir.
Okay. So this is Reach Out with Ray and Steve. So, Don, I'm going to ask you, scouting and recruiting, what's the secret to your success there?
Well, I really believe that the scouting, with the recruiting, but more so, because I was an advanced scout, okay? So I used to watch, the games that we were playing the teams the next several weeks.
Right.
And I pick up a lot of things from pitching now. I pick up a lot of things on hitters, you know what I mean? So when I call pitches sometimes, I'll know how to get a guy out, because by watching them stride, or or do something in their at bat, I will also understand that and break that down very, very quickly. Something that I did when I was with the Pirates.
Well, now, Frank, now that you're in New York, you have to watch Disco Dom a little bit. Yeah, because you guys are going to be like very competitive with each other. I'm looking forward to that. And,
we're playing them.
You know, yes, I know. I can't wait.
So you guys look at bet on the game?
Yeah. No, hey, watch that.
That's something that Frank is learning, right?
Yeah.
Stick to it, man.
Stick to
it.
It's going to be so much fun to see the two of you going at it. The fans are going to love it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we can't wait to put all our cameras there.
Let me tell this story about real quick about my first college game. And this was in the fall. Now, you know, we all know now the fall is like an exhibition season for us, right? But when I took over the job, as I told you, I wanted to instill discipline and love for the game and passion. The first game we played in the fall, and I didn't realize about the exhibition season, but I was just looking to win.
Right.
First game, second inning, guy made a bum call at first base. I ran out, and it was in his face, yelling at him and screaming at him like Billy Martin or Earl Weaver. Okay, the umpire was looking at me like this, like, Dom, are you crazy? What are you doing? It's only the fall. And I said, what do you mean it's only the fall? It doesn't matter. I want to win. I want you to make the right call. Little did I know, like the year after that, I went up to the guy and said, listen, I really apologize. Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to do that. I didn't know. I thought it meant something, you know?
The games are very lax in the fall.
I wear shorts in the fall.
I remember that. I remember his first fall. Because number one, I went to a lot of games and he didn't even realize that I was there.
Uh-huh.
My son was actually playing for
Dowling. Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So when they went to play Dowling, my son was a relief pitcher.
Right.
And he went in to close that game. And I was like, you gotta go, John, go get him. This is Scala. I want his butt. I've been watching all fall. He goes crazy. He thinks he's Billy Martin, etc.
Sometimes I think you're right. Sometimes I say to myself, boy, this is something that Billy would do.
My God.
But I've calmed down.
He didn't even know that I was there. And so my son gave up two rockets that were caught, okay, and a pop-up, game over. And all of a sudden, Scala comes over. I know Negron. Oh, you're related to. And they're like, yeah, Dom, that's my son.
That's right.
Yeah, that's my son.
I remember that now.
That's my son. I remember that.
When he said that, he said, my father's over there. And I said, oh, shit. You were behind the tree or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I was fishing through the archives. I actually saw you in a New York Tech uniform.
My old alma mater.
I don't know if we have a picture of that, but.
Frank didn't believe me. I know.
Well, we got to show up, viewers.
Like, yeah, okay, yeah, you went to New York Tech.
Afro in it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Our viewers can see it right now.
For my fans out there, I will sign plenty of New York Tech pictures later, okay? It's okay.
That's very good.
It's
Frank.
Almost like Joe DiMaggio wearing the Red Sox uniform.
Yeah. Almost like that. Frank, what was the toughest pitch you played against?
Toughest pitcher for me? I can't say one. There's two that I always mention. Pedro Martinez and Mariano Rivera. Those were the two that gave me the toughest time.
Yeah. Why Mariano though? Why?
So Mariano had one pitch,
right,
the cutter, right? And me being a left-handed hitter, he would come in and jam me all the time. So when I was in Texas, I talked to, after we played the Yankees, I talked to Rafael Palmeiro, and I said, Rafi, he jams me every time. There's nothing I can do. And he said, yeah, move way up in the box. I go, what are you talking about? He's throwing 95 with a cutter. Now I'm going to make it 98, you know, if I'm way up in the box. He goes, no, you're going to get it before it cuts.
Yeah. Good
and
point.
I said,
right.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And sure enough, that's what I did. I moved way up in the box and I started to have some success against him.
That's good.
But he was such a smart pitcher. Whenever you took a swing, he always knew how to just move it that much more in the next time.
Right.
And then he could read your body language. And if, you know, you took a good swing on one inside, he would backdoor that one And the backdoor one that he would throw to lefties, it looked like it was a mile away. Yeah, and sure right. enough, it would come back. And yeah. you'd look on the video. You'd go in the clubhouse, look on the video, and say, there's no chance that – there's no way that that's a strike. And you would look and say, oh, my gosh, that was a strike. That came around and hit the corner. So he was nasty. And then Pedro Martinez, his arm speed was the exact same for the fastball and the changeup. And wow. his changeup was – 10 to 15 miles an hour different than his fastball. And, you know, it seemed like whenever I was looking for the fastball, he threw me the changeup. Whenever I was sitting on the changeup, he threw me the fastball. He was just so smart. Such a smart pitcher. You know, he would really only use those two pitches. But then whenever, you know, you started taking some good swings, he flipped that curveball. And his curveball was actually really good, but he didn't use it as much. And he just gave me fits. He really did.
Growing up, Yankee fan, Met fan?
Yankee fan.
Your favorite player?
Don Mattingly.
Why?
He was a left-handed hitter, obviously, yeah. like myself. And you guys know Donnie. He would change his stance all the time.
Right.
In the backyard when I was playing with my dad, whether it be wiffle ball or if he was throwing me a baseball, I would change my stance. Whatever Don Mattingly's stance was that month, I would change it to emulate him. I played a lot of first base as well when I wasn't playing second or short, and just a great, great human being.
Yes.
You know, whenever I would go to the Yankee Stadium, I'd always see him signing autographs and interacting
just
with the
cool
fans.
Guy.
And then it was really cool when I got to the major leagues and was able to go over to him and talk to him just a great guy.
Excited? Were you excited? Was it a thrill?
Oh, it was.
You know,
it was great.
That's great. You know what's funny? You talk about like got to the big leagues and you went over to them. The guy I really loved when I first got to the big leagues.
But were you a Yankee or a Met fan?
I was
up.
A Yankee fan, but the guy who I always loved as a player was Carl Yastrzemski.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just loved the way he was the bat, and I wasn't allowed to go over to him and talk to him or get an autograph because. In those days, as you know, they told us you can't associate with anybody. You know, in the old days, they didn't want you hanging around the cage talking to anybody or asking somebody for an autograph or whatever, you know. But I just got a quick story about Donnie. You know, I use Donnie as an example for the kids in my camps. I teach kids from 5 years old to 14 years old, my little camps in the summer. And sometimes the parents will come over to me and say, why is my son hitting off a tee? You know, he plays pitch baseball. Why is he hitting off a tee? I say, well, ma'am, did you ever hear of a guy named Don Mattingly? And she said, yeah. She goes, well, if it's good enough for him, it's good enough for your son. Because Don Mattingly, before he stepped into the batting cage, if you remember this, you might remember this, they had a screen set up with a tee every day before he got into the batting cage.
And
he took 100 swings.
Yeah.
And that's what I would use. I would use that to the parents and say, if it's good enough for him, it's good enough for your son. Mm-hmm. You know.
True.
And another great player that used to do that was Barry Bonds. He was another guy that used to do that. His father instilled that in him every day to swing off the tee. Muscle memory, we call it.
Hey, the one thing, here's another one. One of my claims to fame is that I was one of the great babysitters in baseball history, okay? Because I babysat Robbie. I babysat Hal Steinbrenner.
I know you did. I remember.
I babysat Barry, okay, and his brother Bobby Jr.
Wow.
And the one thing about, you know, when I knew the greatness of Barry and Robbie was in 1975, they lived in the same building. The Alomars and the Bonds lived in the same building in Riverdale Avenue of the Bronx, section of the Bronx. And this one Saturday, the Bonds and the Alomars, they were going to have a date night. So they were going out together, and I had to babysit the Bonds and the Alomar kids. And I was always very happy to because that meant a double tip, okay, from the Bonds, you know, from Robbie, from Sandy, and from Bobby. You know what I'm saying?
Isn't it great the kids that were growing up, but when we were in the game. What about Ken Griffey Jr.?
Check this out.
He was in the clubhouse with Ken Griffey.
When I knew their greatness was that Bobby Bonds had a ping pong table in the living room. And to see Robbie play against Barry, it was like
The Chinese. Like this. Remember that, Robbie? When you used to do it, you and Barry, like this? Remember back and forth?
Because he's watching.
Frank was looking back there at the Beatles. But that's how I knew.
But do you remember when Ken Griffey Jr. was 13 years old?
Yes.
And he would be taking batting practice and he'd be hitting balls in the right field seats before the game. You know, that's how great he was. And Billy used to throw him out of the clubhouse, remember? He didn't want him in there.
Well, you know what? The thing about Billy was that the one thing about Kenny was that he was like a little smart aleck per se.
Oh, okay.
And Billy saw that. He said, you know, I don't like that kid that much.
Really? Well, he used to run in the clubhouse after a loss.
Yeah, get him
and
out
Billy
of here.
Didn't want anybody in there
get
after a
here.
Loss.
Get him out of here.
Yeah, that's what he would say. Get that kid out of here.
Get him out of here. Are you responsible for him? Get him out of here.
So, Joe, 2018 is over. Where does Bryce Harper and Manny Machado end up?
That's a good question. If we knew that, you know, we'd be putting
money on the GM, too.
There we go.
I'd be the GM right now.
I don't think the Yankees need
well,
either.
They don't need either of them. No, they need pitching. They don't need another big at bat to strike out 200 times in a year. They need a guy who can. They need starting pitching. If I was the Yankees, right. I'd go after. You know what I was saying? If Clayton Kershaw decides to opt out of his contract, I'd be all over that. If I was the Yankees,
right?
But you know, there's always going to be a team out there that's going to take Bryce Harper. I honestly think he goes back to the Nationals at the end of the day, but he's going to be going for top dollar.
Right.
Basically, whoever Boris gets to get the most money out of him will get Bryce Harper. Manny Machado, on the other hand, I think he hurt himself in the World Series in his playoffs. He seems like, and you didn't really see this back in
you didn't see any of that in Baltimore.
Back in Baltimore, but he became like this. Looked very immature as a player.
Yeah, I agree.
During the playoffs. So I don't know. I think that's going to kind of hurt him. I don't see him going back to the Dodgers, but I can see him. You know, there's got to be a mystery team out there.
Right.
You know, maybe the Texas Rangers, or maybe, you know, there's always one of these teams out there that you don't expect.
Philadelphia.
Right.
Philadelphia. Right, that could be it.
Machado, Philadelphia.
Okay.
But, you know, I always respected Manny Machado. I think he's a very well-spoken man, and I like the way he played the game as far as, you know, his smoothness, you know, and the way he hits. But I did not like what he did in the playoffs and World Series when he tried to kick both of those guys.
He didn't do
it. He could have seriously hurt Pierce.
Yep.
And to hurt a World Series MVP in, like, the eighth inning of a game, you know what I mean? That's not the right thing to do.
Dom, it just, you know, it just showed he wasn't smart. The world stage, you're a free agent.
Yeah.
Make belief that you hustle.
Right.
Make belief that you really care. Make belief that, you know, just for seven more games.
Right.
I mean, I've never seen a stock go down so fast on a player.
Yet like there'll still be somebody that wants him.
But not for the money that he could have gotten.
And even though the Yankees could use a shortstop right now because, you know, don't believe the hype, okay? And I'll give you an example of a guy on the Mets who had exact same surgery and he still hasn't come back. T.J. Rivera had Tommy John surgery at the end of last year, and he was rehabbing. He didn't even get activated this year. So, you know, expect Didi out for the whole season. If you get him even part of it, it's bonus.
Yeah.
So you need a shortstop. You don't sign this guy.
Right.
Because you know what? The Yankees, as constructed right now, is a very likable team. There's no real jerks on the team. No, you know, so you put him in there, it's going to really, I think, hurt the dynamic. You know, a guy like Boone is going to be, like, probably shaking his head trying to control him. It's going to be very difficult for it. You know, that's a time bomb. Get a pitcher or two, and that's the way the Yankees should call their offseason.
You know, here's the way a GM would think on this DD versus Machado. What does DD make? About $12 million right now.
Right.
If he has to sign a free agent contract, he's going to have to get 18 to 20. I would think the way he's been, you know, with his numbers and what he means to the team. So if they want Machado for 25 to 30. They figure they're only getting, they're getting it for 10 million more. Mm-hmm. From what, so now you have to make that, you know, you have to make that correlation.
Sure.
You know, for 10 million more, do I want Machado over Didi? Is he a better infielder? You know, is he a better person? Is he a better hitter? These are the things that they juggle. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These are the things that they juggle.
I'm sure they do, but the, you know, with, I just honestly think this guy, you know, could be bad news for you.
I agree.
Gil from McCarran Park.
Yes.
Says, sign Murphy and pitching. Sign Murphy and pitching. You have Torres for shortstop. Okay.
Why would you want Daniel Murphy on the downside?
I'm just letting you know what Dom Scala's fans are saying.
I think.
Just until Didi's ready.
Murphy and pitchers.
It could be all next year.
Put Torres at short.
Here's my take on moving Gleyber Torres to shortstop. Yes, he was a shortstop, and he was probably a pretty good shortstop. But you made him a second baseman, and he was doing really, really well over there, both offensively and defensively. He was comfortable. It's tough to move a guy now to shortstop, because I think once they moved him to shortstop, that's when he started to go downward, if you remember correctly, okay? Right. And he wasn't the same smooth person, because shortstop, you got to work a little different than second. Am I right, Frank?
Yep.
Second, you can wait on the ball a little bit more. Shortstop, you got to be moving a little bit more.
Right.
You know, not that he can't do it, but I think he got very comfortable at second base. And he likes second base, and now he's got to play shortstop.
I fully agree with you. You don't move Torres.
I won't move.
But also, you know, it was the second time around the league that when they started doing that too, the league starting to figure him out. He's going to have to make adjustments as a hitter.
And he got hurt.
So, you know, you keep him at second base. You just say, the job's yours. You don't have to worry about it. You know, go out and hit and figure out, you know, digging you out how to adjust to it.
Okay, now, all of a sudden, Frank Catalanato's people are popping in, because evidently your bench coach, Jimmy Gels, says, give Frank a snack. He needs to eat constantly. What's that all about?
We're both on the camera together, so he looks a lot thinner.
So, thanks, Jimmy. So I constantly am eating something, whether it's a protein bar, almonds or whatever. I'm always hungry. When we go out for practice, if I don't eat that whole time, I'll have a splitting headache. I'll be miserable. So they're always watching me putting things in my mouth. They're like, what are you eating now? So they give me a hard time.
Boy, you know what? If I'm your bench coach, I am making sure that I have snacks to give you so you don't get on my butt.
Right? Exactly.
Okay? Yeah, no question about it. Now you have a Dr. Ben. He says he's your dentist. I don't know who this guy is. What is that?
Dr. Bernard?
Yeah.
In Bayside?
Yeah.
Is he a dentist in Bayside?
No. Dr. Ben, dentist in Bayside. He says he took care of your teeth. They look great. Thank you.
I don't know who that is.
Okay. And then Scotty, always Scotty G says, I've always been a big fan of yours. Caught a foul ball at Yankees. There you go. Okay, very good.
But Frank, you also have a nonprofit. Talk about that a little bit.
So we started the Frank Catalanato Foundation back in 2001. My oldest daughter was born in 1999 with a vascular birthmark on her nose. And we went to local doctors here, and they said, don't worry about it. It'll go away. And it's called a hemangioma. And it didn't go away. It got more red and bigger, and you know, as first-time parents, we were very concerned. I got traded to Texas, and when I was in Texas, we met a lady named Linda Shannon, who was the head of the Vascular Birthmark Foundation, and she told us, gave us the right doctors to go to, doctors that were able to treat these birthmarks, and my daughter had two laser surgeries and a reconstructive surgery, and we felt like we had to really get involved and help out that cause, because they helped us so much. So we started the Frank Catalanato Foundation, which helps support the Vascular Birthmark Foundation, and we run events to raise money and raise awareness as well We have golf outings every year here on Long Island, and it's nice to be able to give back to you know, to a cause that helped me out and my family.
And how's your daughter doing?
She's doing great. She's 19 years old, wow, almost 20. She's in her second year at Salisbury in Maryland, playing volleyball. So she's doing really well. And after those laser surgeries and reconstructive surgeries, you can't even tell that she ever had the birthmark. Wow. She looks, you know, she's beautiful. And, you know, even if you got up close, you wouldn't even be able to tell that, that she had them. So they did they did a great job.
Good stuff.
That's good.
Unbelievable.
And Dom, you do a lot of baseball camps, and giving back is in your DNA too.
Yes, I try to give some, like, sometimes kids can't afford to come, and, you know, I try to give scholarships out to kids. If I know a kid that really wants to play and he can't afford it, you know, I'll just bring him in. I'll just bring him in. And I think Ray knows I do a charity game every year at Delphi.
Yes.
We've done one with Hank Shanks.
Yes.
Okay. 1 year.
We did a couple.
Did several.
Yeah, while my son was playing, we played against you.
Right, exactly.
That's right.
And then, you know, I try to do a different cause, pediatric cancer.
Right.
Alzheimer's. We try to pick something different. This past year, we did the Brooklyn Borough Cup with Gary Perrone.
Okay, yes.
And over at the Brooklyn Cyclones.
I mean, aren't you on their Hall of Fame or something like that?
Yes, I was inducted in the Hall of Fame. Nice. Yeah, it's on the wall there.
It's on the Brooklyn wall there.
That's the New York Sandlot Association.
Yes. Yeah. And DeLuca Bakery.
Yes, DeLuca. That's in Williamsburg.
What
North
the?
6th Street. North 6th Street.
Like this.
It's all right, man.
It's unbelievable. The Luca Bakery. Yeah, do you get free bakery stuff?
Best cookies.
Here we go. Okay.
I don't think they're in business any longer.
Dom has never paid.
That's why they're not in business.
They had the half moon cookies with sprinkles. They were the best. Right across from my church.
So you got a couple of guys waiting for you for some money for the show today. But we're just about out of time. You guys are great. Talking baseball, life, and
great show. You guys made
it
great.
Thank you for having us.
Well, because we were able to be real.
Yes.
We were able just to have a conversation.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Even with a reporter here. You know what I'm saying?
Reporters are people too.
Sometimes.
Yeah, we all can't be. Yeah. Talk show host.
Where's Henry Heck? We need
Henry Heck when you need him. Yeah, and Phil Pepe and the boys.
Phil Pepe.
You know.
Yeah.
But listen, guys, thank you so very much. I can't wait for next season and to see you guys go up against.
You're gonna come again?
I'm definitely gonna go. I mean, it's my alma mater, man.
March 5th.
Only have race sing the national anthem.
That's a game.
There we go.
Listen, come March 5th, bring a shovel.
Ray, can you wear that? The NYIT jersey.
You know, I'm looking for it.
It'll fit me now.
You know, it didn't fit me then. I had to put extra shirts underneath to make it.
How many years did you go to New York Tech?
Just one.
Okay. Get a donation from him.
Thanks,
alumni.
I'll bring the bakery.
Alumni.
Well, fellas, thanks so much, Ray. Another show in the books. And come on back next week for Reach Out with Ray and Steve.
We will be back. Bat Boy will return. Bat Boy.
for me. The sound of all your loaded gun. This outbreak war has just begun. The sound of all your loaded gun. This broken man has already won.
Hold my mind clear.